I'm Nikki Kristoff, and welcome to Teched Up. On today's episode, New York Times bestselling author Ashley Vance joins me remotely to geek out over the new space race. I know I'm trying not to talk about Elon Musk so much or honestly even think about him, but it's totally impossible when it comes to rockets launching satellites into space. Elon's also emblematic of the kind of innovators who get into this space race, and Ashley and I talk all about it in this episode. Today's guest is Ashley Vance. Ashley, thank you for joining us remotely.
Thank you for having me.
So we are talking today not about one of the things you're most known for, which is Elon Musk. You do not have to comment on this. I'm tired of being dominated by a petulant man-child, but you have written a book on Elon Musk, literally called Elon Musk. It's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about your newest book, When the Heavens Went on Sale. So tell us a little bit just about the high level, what the point of this book is.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the title tries to get at it. I mean, people have taken a few cracks at commercial space over the decades, some of them not terribly successful. I think Elon and SpaceX are pretty successful. And then, you know, it had sort of kicked off this renewed interest in commercial space. And I covered this pretty extensively and just noticed after all these false starts the last few years, it's just the heavens are on sale. This is a capitalist exercise now, and this balance of power that's existed for so long with really just a handful of governments controlling most of what happens in space, I think is over. I don't know if it'll be over. You know, the business cases on a lot of this stuff remains questionable and to be determined, but 100% we're about to find out if space can be a capitalist exercise or not.
Exactly. So I want to just frame up the thesis of the book, which is it's a business book. It's talking about the business of space. It's not really talking about rockets. It's not really talking about, there's obviously the kind of Jeffrey Bezos, Elon Musk competition for these extremely far-flung ideas of moon colonies and getting to Mars and private space travel. But you're talking about, and what I thought was very interesting about this book, is something most people never think about, which is right above our heads, we are being circled by a huge number of satellites. And people don't think about it, they don't know about it, and you dig into how that evolved.
Yeah, I mean, I think stuff like Elon talking about going to Mars gets attention, and space tourism and all that stuff is fine and interesting on different levels. It was just very clear to me. I think it's funny. I think people tune into these SpaceX launches all the time, and sometimes they're taking humans to the ISS, but most of the time they're flying satellites. I don't even think like the average person on the street, they just see a rocket. I don't even think they know fully what it's doing. And it was, as I covered this industry off and on in my day job for Business Week, it was just so obvious to me that the thing that's real now is sending up tons of satellites and exponentially more satellites than we've ever set up before. And if you're interested in money and sort of power and what's actually going on, low Earth orbit is where all the action is. And Elon, again, and SpaceX are dominant there, but it was also amazing just as I went around the world. I mean, there's tons of characters trying to take a crack at this, and this is a global race, and it's full of people, the likes of which we've just never seen before, are not the stereotypical, you know, space people, MIT PhDs and governments and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's actually worth, so the subtitle of the book is about the misfits and geniuses racing to put space within reach. But let's step back just a beat and talk about, when we think about space historically, we think about big government programs, Russia versus the US, NASA. But once we retired the shuttle, that sort of ended. And I'm curious if you can just give a quick overview of that history and how we ended up in this place where it's privatized.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I stole an idea from this guy, Alex McDonald, who's the chief economist for NASA. And I think it's pretty spot on. You know, if you go back far enough to like the 1910s and 20s, there were actual rocket startups in the United States and Germany and Russia. And it looked like this very well could be a bunch of rich people had put money into telescopes previously. It was kind of like the thing rich people did back then if they were vaguely into science and space. And those people started putting money into rockets, and it looked like it might head that way, you know. And then we have these two world wars, and obviously World War II really kicks off this space race and this government-backed tradition where this becomes the story of nation states trying to show their technological and military might, and we're sending humans to the moon, and so you need big rockets and nothing can fail, and this whole model just gets cemented in so many ways. I mean, the rockets after the 60s and 70s hardly changed at all. The engines hardly changed. The computing hardware, the stuff we send up into space, became very antiquated. There's just this reluctance to tinker with anything and have it go wrong. And, you know, it's only now, finally, that we're kind of getting back to this spot where it's not just governments, it's not even billionaires, it's venture capitalists all over the world that are pouring money into this stuff. And now, for the first time ever, we have, like, I argue, Moore's Law coming to space. I mean, most of these satellites were running on like 20, 30-year-old radios and telescopes, and there was just such a reluctance to accept that consumer electronics had come so far that they could survive the rigors of space. And so this is what makes all this very exciting, is that there's this clean slate that's washed across the whole thing. With that, there's just all these new interesting players who can take a crack at this.
Okay, and even though I started this show by just trashing Elon Musk, because I'm really mad about Twitter, he has SpaceX is an American phenomenon, where you said it sort of in passing, but just to put a finer point on it, that is how, for a while, Americans were getting to the International Space Station. Like, we needed private
still
funding.
It still is. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I have more issues with Elon probably than even most. But, you know, there's no question SpaceX sort of, like, fantastically is his most, it should be his least successful, highest risk company. It's his most successful, most stable company. That doesn't make much sense. But, I mean, I'm not a huge patriot, nationalistic kind of person. If you are, you know, SpaceX is the ultimate American dream story. Like, immigrant comes to the United States and in 20 years builds the country's most successful, like, the U.S. aerospace program. The shuttle retired. It was just totally dominated by military contractors like Boeing and Lockheed that had very little motivation to do anything new, reduce costs. We were about to fall behind China in historic, alarming fashion, and this guy who wants to get to Mars somehow has made, you know, SpaceX is unquestionably the most successful rocket company and now the largest satellite company on Earth. Governments, another corporate rival, they just have no competition. They're sort of running laps around everyone.
Okay, and for the record, I am a patriotic nationalist, like neoliberal, like lunatic, and so I'm for it. But I also think one thing I really want to get into, you talk specifically about certain companies, and it was again, Elon Musk and SpaceX that got that first private Falcon 1 into orbit in 2008?
Yep.
And then after that, it sort of broke open this business model, and I want to eventually talk a little bit about the geopolitics of how private American, well, maybe public or privately held American companies have more things in space and maybe a stronger program than anyone but the Chinese government. But before we get to that, let's just talk about after that successful orbit, you look at the companies and the founders that got into this space race.
Yeah. I mean, you know, even Elon had a lot of money to fund SpaceX and then had other investors. But, like, historically, investing in space was just a horrible idea. And I think it's still not, as I argue in the book, certainly not the most rational thing you could do and probably not the best outlay of your capital. But I think SpaceX's success made it sort of believable to other people that this was possible. And then, of course, you had this generation of engineers and entrepreneurs who just see themselves as, oh, maybe I can be the next Elon Musk. It becomes this like emotional kind of pursuit. And then you have this weird thing that happened where all these VCs, it was kind of FOMO. It's like, oh, these guys have a rocket. I want a rocket. I want to be involved in this. Rocket companies historically make almost no money. It's a terrible business to be in. And yet everybody wanted to invest in one. You know, there's people I write about in the book who, like, their rocket startup didn't even have really like anything different than the five before it, and they were still getting funding. So yeah, you know, I think it just unlocked all of this latent potential and interest for young engineers. Space had become really sad, and like, you know, there was no like 24-year-old coming out of college is like, I'm dying to work at Boeing and or even NASA, you know, maybe if you're doing something very specific that only NASA can do. But otherwise, there were all these young kids who dreamed about space. And now finally, okay, here we go. Now we have an opportunity to do it too.
Yeah. And you touched on something. So when I emailed you to see if you would come on this podcast, I mentioned that I have a personal interest in this. So in 2007, I moved to Silicon Valley. My former spouse was at the time, went to the GSB, to Stanford Business School, and he was former Intel. He did reconnaissance work with satellites. And so he co-founded Skybox Imaging, which was a nanosatellite startup in my living room. And so I actually have a lot of familiarity with this space. And in the beginning of the book, I was sort of tickled to see Skybox mentioned because they were ultimately acquired by my employer, Google, and then sold to Planet Labs, which is one of the featured companies in your book. So at the time, to your point, his co-founders, they were business school students, engineering backgrounds, had that passion for space. It's like the allure of space. And suddenly it looked like you could actually have a successful startup. But I remember them going up and down Sand Hill Road trying to explain, like, these are going to be small satellites and yeah, they're going to take live images. And it was highly leveraged, high risk. They had to launch out of former Soviet states. You know, it was just the stakes were super, super high. It's not an app, right? It's heavy, heavy hardware. So anyway, that's my personal connection to it. And when I saw the book, I'm like, oh my gosh, I actually know a lot about small satellites.
And they, you know, like you mentioned, Planet Labs is one of these main characters in the book. But Skybox kind of came on the scene almost the exact same time. And really, those two companies are what generated my interest and sort of enduring interest in possibly even doing this as a book. It was just kind of like a weird twist of fate that they both didn't make it separately. And I could have spent many pages on Skybox. I have a lot of characters in this book already and had to focus a little bit. But, you know, I think that founding team deserves as much credit as anyone for kicking this off.
Yeah, definitely. And so it was funny, not funny, haha, but funny. Wow. Hard to believe. After we had separated, I moved to DC and I was at Google and I used to oversee anything that was sort of a government deal. And I got a note, oh, we're acquiring Skybox Imaging for a huge amount of money. I thought, well, good for them. But this sort of leads to, you had said it's a long story and it's not in the book, but there are two types of satellites that make money: imaging satellites and like the space internet, I've heard you call it. So yeah, the kind of connectivity. And my hunch, nobody read me into this, but was that Google acquired a imaging satellite system and then really wanted connectivity because they were so focused at the time in worldwide access to the internet. And then they ended up spinning it off and selling it to Planet. And I'm not as curious about that as just explaining a quick story about Planet Labs, which is a very cool company.
Yeah. I mean, I could go on a whole tangent about Google's space aspirations because it wanted to play in imaging and communications, but has sort of just become a passive investor. But yeah, you know, Planet Labs is just this incredible thing that people should know about. I mean, they've surrounded the Earth with about 250 satellites. Some of them are shoebox sized. Some of them are like mini refrigerator size. Those are the old Skybox ones. And you know, historically, imaging satellites are like $500 million to $1 billion. It's like the size of a school bus. It takes like 6 years to build them. They're supposed to stay in space for 20 years. They can only look at really where you tell them to look, points of interest. So even massive governments like the US or China or Russia, you know, they have a relatively limited number of these satellites. You have to direct them to whatever you're trying to spy on. And Planet came up with this idea. It's much less espionage. You're not like seeing faces and stuff like that, but they've surrounded the planet with so many satellites that they can see everything that's happening across the entire landmass of the Earth. Every day they take about 12 to 16 pictures of every spot. And so, you know, I write about it in the book as like this real-time accounting system for human activity on Earth. So what's happening with forests in the Amazon? Where is oil moving out of the Middle East? You know, how many cars are in a Walmart parking lot? What's happening with like refugees somewhere in Africa? And you can, you just get this sense of truth through these images that used to be parceled out by governments that you had to like trust or not trust. And then even then the governments, like I said, had only this limited information. So it's just like this whole new era of data. You know, I think of it as like a Google search engine looking down at Earth.
And I like that you mentioned something, but I want to sort of go even more into depth. The idea that you can monitor for climate issues, I think for natural disasters, for seeing in real time what's happening, this kind of imagery is essential and important globally.
I think this is the key to making so much of whatever we're trying to do with climate change work, because, you know, like you said, first of all, these images, if there's a volcano erupting, something like that, I mean, you get a sense of the scale, exactly what's happening when a hurricane hits somewhere. You can see what areas are flooded. But on the bigger picture, you know, these satellites now literally can count every tree on Earth. They use AI to figure out what type of tree it is. So they figure out its biomass, then they calculate exactly how much carbon dioxide it sucks down. They're looking over all these oil fields in Texas and Oklahoma. They can see methane leaks. They can see exactly how much methane is coming out. You know, so I think if we're going to like put real metrics around things like carbon credits, where you've bought some forest in South America and you have no idea if somebody's planting something there or not, or you're trying to tax a company for their toll on the environment. I just think these satellites are like our only hope of adding actual metrics around this stuff. And we're like not far off at all. So Planet is already doing that now. There's specialized startups that are like just looking at things like methane and just looking at trees and making this their business.
Yeah. So I think that's the moneymaker, right? You can have hedge funds and investors who want to count cars and parking lots, and then you can have companies who are potentially either voluntarily or going to be forced to, you know, be carbon neutral or report on their emissions. I think it's a great and important business model. So there's imaging on one side, and then the other side is this space internet. So yeah, this is the Starlink kind of concept. Which, yeah, do you want to talk about that as a business model?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like we said, the rockets don't really make much money, but these satellites potentially do. And there's this huge race going on, which, again, SpaceX is in the lead on, to make this space internet. And this is really what's driving this exponential increase in the number of satellites. So until like 2020, we had about 2,500 satellites in low Earth orbit. Over just the last 3 years, that's tripled now to about 10,000, and it's set to go to about 100,000 or 200,000 because SpaceX wants to put up about 14,000 satellites. OneWeb wants to do the same. Amazon is about to launch a fleet of 14,000. China's going to want to do the same thing. Anyone who can sort of afford this is going to want to have a space internet system, which is essentially a telecom system that is not really bounded by geography. And it, more importantly, I think people have underestimated this, is that it will provide this always on internet, just kind of washing over the Earth. And like a lot of us think that's like not a big deal because we're like on the internet all the time, or you have your cell phone when you're traveling around. But, you know, there's these huge gaps of all this stuff we've heard about for years, like the Internet of Things and like sensors on container ships and in farms and like, you know, reporting about what's happening on Earth. This really depends on some sort of always on kind of fabric. And so I think people have underestimated this. To me, it's like so clearly like 1996, we're laying fiber all over the world and building data centers. We're just building this new infrastructure in this computing shell around the Earth. And I think it's going to change. I actually think that's, to your point, where the money is going to be. And so far people are kind of focused on like, oh, I get internet at my vacation house in the woods. But I think it's much, much, much bigger than that. When you have this like always on fabric, things like self-driving cars and drones and what have you, it changes everything.
Yeah. And I mean, even at a human level, if you're in a fishing village in Alaska, or you're somewhere in Africa, nobody's ever going to build connectivity out to there. It makes no financial sense. But if you can just flip it on from low Earth orbit, you expand people who have access to the internet. Although we'll have to all stop faking like we can't get on the internet.
Yeah. I mean, that's the huge downside, is that, you know, even when you're on Mount Everest, maybe they already have internet there now. You will never escape it after the next couple of years. I mean, you'll just forever be on the internet. But you're totally right. I sort of skipped a couple steps ahead. Like half the world's population cannot get high speed internet, and there's just a mountain of evidence that the second high speed internet reaches a country, you know, education levels go up, economic opportunity goes up drastically. I always think of somewhere like Cuba, which still just doesn't have a fiber optic cable touching it, you know, and the whole country would sort of change if we could get that worked out politically. So, you know, it's a big deal.
And actually, that is a really interesting point that brings up another theme that this raises, which is governments and nation states are losing the ability to control things. Like, the reason there's no fiber optic cable to Cuba is obvious. We're not going to allow it, but they don't have to necessarily go through the U.S. government. I mean, admittedly, U.S. companies may not be able to help them, but if you've got, you know, if it's cheap to put up a small satellite with these, you know, off-the-shelf electronics, somebody is going to be able to bring connectivity to Cuba.
Yeah. I mean, the whole world order is about to be shook up in a lot of ways, I think. You've had all these countries. I go immediately to the war in Ukraine, where you had, like, Russia, you know, is just up there as one of the top two space superpowers of all time, and totally had space, like, turned against it the second, even before it started to go into Ukraine. It was like Planet Labs and Maxar, all their images showed the Russian troops amassing on the border of Ukraine while Putin was saying he wasn't going to attack, you know. And then the second they moved in, same satellites saw all the Russian troop movements, like all those pictures we had of the Russian convoys stalled out on these freeways. These, you know, it was just so embarrassing to the Russians. You just have these images on the front page of all these papers. And then they naturally went in to try to take out the communication system in Ukraine. And then it turned out SpaceX had shipped all these Starlink antennas, which they still rely on now. And you know, it's incredible. Like, this is a country. Ukraine did have, like, a long space history, but certainly that was many years ago and had not been, like, investing in its, like, space infrastructure. And then it just totally relied on the private sector. And then you had, like, these weird things where, like, Elon became this, like, nation state, you know, for a while. He wanted to, like, turn off the internet in Ukraine because it seems like SpaceX was kind of, like, donating a lot of the stuff and it was expensive. But, you know, if the U.S. government wanted to replicate what SpaceX was doing, they could not do it because SpaceX has thousands of these satellites. The U.S. government has, like, a handful and has no space internet ability at all. So I think we're in this really interesting era where like, things that we've sort of, this balance of power, things we've taken for granted start to go away. Even on the imaging stuff, while it's not traditionally used for really hardcore espionage, you know, as long as you're not, like, in the access of evil, you can tap into planet's service and see what's happening in your country now for a pretty relatively low cost. And so you don't, you know, if you're, I don't know, Bolivia, you don't have to send up 10 imaging satellites of your own anymore.
Right. It levels the playing field for countries who are able to see it. And something just to bring up, you brought up Russia. And I think that there's a lot of sort of dunking on NASA and about why they, you know, they have a handful of satellites and then you have Elon Musk and Starlink have all of these satellites. But at the end of the day, NASA is funded by taxpayers, and are taxpayers willing to pay for something incredibly expensive that they blow up all the time? That's, like, sort of in space, it's not unusual for stuff to go super wrong. You know, I'm not sure there's a lot of taxpayer willingness to fund it. So in some ways, not venture capitalists and billionaires who right now have a PR problem, but they are subsidizing things that we do want Americans to have access to. And that I just don't think our government, because our citizens are just probably not going to fund that right now.
Yeah. I mean, when I step back and just look at all kinds of things, self-driving cars, just the rise of alternative energy, even like AI, you know, we have to face the reality that these billionaires and these giant corporations are doing things that like you might have expected to be, like, nationwide government type infrastructure. programs in the past. And I don't think we have like the willingness, like you talked about, or really sort of the efficiency and clarity of thought anymore to like pull some of these things off. And so then you end up in a situation where it's on some levels fantastic that some capitalist built this stuff, but then, you know, you're at the mercy of the capitalist. Like, it, you know, if the US government today wanted to be like the, to the extent we want to be like an AI leader ahead of China, we are completely beholden to Google and Microsoft and OpenAI and their vast data centers. You know, it used to be the case that like the US government had the biggest supercomputers and could do work that like no corporation could match. But that day passed about 25 years ago.
Yeah. And the companies are not really, I mean, they're based in America, but they're global companies. So you don't end up with the same incentives.
Yeah. So, and the motivations of the CEOs, you know, they fluctuate.
Exactly. It's so personality driven, which is actually a good segue into the book. So there are a lot of personalities in this book. And I guess if we start at Falcon 1, but to where we are today, the type of individual in this space and the folks you talk to, I don't want to give everything away in the book, but if there's even one character you could describe, but the type of person who's in this space right now working on space.
Yeah. I kind of start the book with Planet because I think it sort of represented some of this idealism and sort of the familiar place that some of these space things came from, just kind of young kids who were working at NASA who just wanted to see what they could do with satellites. The next main character in the book is this guy, Peter Beck, who's this New Zealander who starts Rocket Lab, which is really like the second coming of SpaceX. And you know, I always thought of his story as like the engineer's kind of hero's journey. He's a guy, he didn't go to college. He's in a country in the middle of nowhere with no space program. And he's built this serious, you know, it's like SpaceX and Rocket Lab, and that's kind of it. And then, you know, I sort of set the book up to be like a bit of a things, the further you go, like things get a little bit crazier and we move a little bit farther away from like our traditional thoughts of who gets into space and why. And I tried to make it quite clear that, yes, I mean, some of these people are all motivated by different things and that this looks much more like a business than we're used to. I laugh because I think like every space movie you've ever seen is like a, it's like our best pilot is facing off against this horrible situation and only like his courage and bravery will solve it while he's aided by like 10,000 of our smartest engineers in this room, you know, this
is in mission control,
right? This is like not what space looks like anymore. I mean, you know, it's the Wild West and people are driven by greed and money. And yes, I mean, a lot of it's still aspirational, but all the rest of the stuff is there.
Okay. So you actually just said something. I was going to end with this, but I'm actually, if you don't mind, I'm going to read this from your book
right now. Please do.
I just was like cheering when I read this sentence. So you're describing sort of the people in the space, which is what the book's going to address. And you say, you shouldn't ask too many questions, think about consequences too long, or let reality interfere with your hopes and dreams. After all, this is space. It's best to just say, fuck it. Let's do this thing because we kind of have to.
You know, and I think that's true. I mean, I think it explains a lot of like it is still kind of aspirational and space still comes with all this mythology and this like centuries of gazing up and you know, I think that's all like somewhere in the heart of this, but now it's a business.
Yeah. And actually one thing about the business and I think we can't talk about a space business without discussing it is you have these weird dunks happening, like Russia shooting its own dumb satellite and then creating a ton of debris. So when you talk about how many satellites, they're exponentially expanding, right? The number of them. And already there are many more overhead than the average person thinks about. Space is big, but it's not that big. And when you blow stuff up and it starts, well, maybe you can just explain it better than I'm doing.
Well, you know, yes. So we're moving to this new era. We don't, like you said, space is big. And I think people sometimes underestimate how big it is. But already, look, I mean, we had like 2,500 objects up there and things collided. Stuff hits the International Space Station all the time. They have like little shields up there, you know, and there's this thing called the Kessler syndrome, which is like the nightmare scenario where you have a satellite crashing to probably another satellite and you know, these things break apart into thousands of pieces, all of which are then traveling like at incredible speeds, and you get this cascading effect. And once, if that does happen, I mean, it's kind of all over. Like, low Earth orbit would be unusable for a very long time unless somebody figured something pretty clever out to clean it up. And not only would that like wreck all this new stuff we've been talking about, but things like GPS, which is like this glue that holds the modern world together, that would be over, you know, and along with all kinds of communications and things we take for granted. And clearly these companies are motivated not to let this happen because it would wreck everything they've been investing in and trying to achieve. I write about at the end of this book, this company, Leo Labs, that is like a air traffic control for this modern system. And so, yes, people are aware of this, but humans, you may know, do not have like the best track record when it comes to like a new territory that needs to be conquered quickly to and like seized,
you totally know,
for the most profitable winner take all kind of scenario. And so we've already seen like the first illegal satellite launches where a startup snuck some tiny satellites onto an Indian rocket, even though the US government told them not to. SpaceX, people give a hard time because there's arguments that can be made that they're not really deorbiting all these satellites they're putting up in the most transparent and like safe way. And I don't know if you also know this, but Elon has a tendency to be like cavalier with some things.
Let us not forget 420, the launch he did that went because it was hilarious and went very poorly.
Yeah. So, you know, there's reason. And I think Russia is just like the, you called it out. I mean, people should stop and think about this for a second. So Russia shot a missile into its own satellite simply to like remind everybody that it could. And if you're asking like why they did that, it's because their space program is crumbling. Like SpaceX, before the war in Ukraine had started, was taking all their business. I mean, you used to use Soyuz rockets, everybody did, to get their satellites into orbit. It was the most consistent, cheapest rocket there was. SpaceX flies more often, is cheaper now. And then, because of the war in Ukraine, nobody wants to do business with the Russians, and their space program was just rife with corruption and was kind of crumbling on its own. And so, and they have no rocket or satellite startups at all. So, you know, if you're in that position, and space is like not, you know, that is something that's like woven into that country's national pride. I mean, like very seriously, this is like not some passing thing. I mean, this will hurt. And so, you know, they probably don't care if the rest of us have a space internet.
I mean, and not constructive to have to blow something up and then you have a jillion pieces of their stuff hitting really essential. But yeah, why would they care? And I think that's the fascinating thing to keep an eye on, especially a lot of our audience is Washington, but it's an unregulated space. You have a small startup that is working on air traffic control, not a world government. You do have coalitions of governments thinking about space junk and how they register, you know, deorbiting and making sure a lot of these satellites are intended to be disposable, but ideally they should come back and burn up. They shouldn't just be up there indefinitely. And I think this is a really interesting area to think about, which is no government owns space. And private companies don't want a bunch of trash in space, but it's not in their interest. And yet they all are racing for money, which money and new frontiers and digging for gold is not exactly what we're known for doing the most responsibly as humans.
Yeah, I think we kind of have a pretty good idea of likely where this ends up. You know, like Leo Labs, yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, it's like a 50-person outfit that kind of just, because we're lucky that they were on top of this and saw an opportunity arrive. Governments can, the US, you know, has the ability to track objects in space. I would argue that these regimes were so outdated, and it used to be the regular cadence for rocket launches for even the best space programs was like one rocket a month. If you did 12 in a year, you know, you were doing great. SpaceX is almost up to one a day. Rocket Labs getting pretty close to like one a week, and then soon more than that. It's like you want regulation on some of this, but it is not clear to me at all that these regulators are prepared for like what is happening or know how to handle it. And the rule usually is there's a lot of regulation around rockets since they're so close to ICBMs and like, are they safe to fly? Where are you going to fly it? There's some regulation around your satellite, especially a communications one, shouldn't interfere with somebody else's. But really the rule is like, once you get the satellite up there, there's just kind of like, that's it. You get to do pretty much what you want. I think New Zealand is the only country I know of that even has laws in place to make sure you deorbit your satellite in some kind of safe manner. So it is, it's classic
New Zealand to be super polite about space.
I was like really impressed with that. Plus, you know, they had no space program before Rocket Lab came along. One of my favorite things is they're like, okay, so Peter Beck comes to the prime minister who I interviewed. He was like in shorts. We were having brunch. He offered to like pick me up at my house to take me to brunch. And he's like, yeah, you know, Peter came to me. He's like, I want to do rockets. And it's like, you know, I'm like, man, we only have like a couple boats and one pretty crappy tank. Like, do we want to get into this? And he's like, how would we even do the legislation around this? And Peter's like, well, we'll take like the NASA, you know, documentation and the FAA documentation. And then we'll just, you know, rip off like the 75% of like the bureaucratic crap that we don't need. And then we'll just like use that. And that's kind of pretty much what they did. And then And then, like you said, they added their little nice New Zealand twist.
They're so nice. Well, I think that's a good place to end. It's a business book, but it's a very readable book. And you talk a lot about the personalities, which are fascinating. We'll put a link so people can buy it in the show notes. But I know you're traveling. You do a lot of different things. You're a busy person. And I'm really grateful that you took the time to come on and talk about this.
Thank you so much. Can I plug one last thing
along
my
Disney
personal line? Coming like in September. So I make a travel television show called Hello World, and we have a whole new season coming on Bloomberg and YouTube in September. We got 10 new episodes. I just got back from Nigeria filming that, and anyway, that one's near and dear to my heart if people want to check that out too.
We will drop in Hello World a link. We'll drop in a link to buy this book. I have an independent bookseller I send people to, although, you know, Amazon's fine. They're going to launch 14,000 satellites. We can support indie booksellers.
Absolutely.
And we'll let people find you on Twitter and other places too. But I'm really thankful that you took the time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
We're almost 60 episodes into Teched Up, and this was the first one with no edits. Don't let anybody tell you that podcasting is easy. It's actually really hard to get the hang of. And I'm grateful to our guests, listeners, and Selchik, our producer, for his patience as I learn the ropes. On the next episode, Paul Rosenzweig, former official of the Department of Homeland Security, will join me in the studio to talk cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, and how we can mitigate risks to the United States. It sounds grim, but it's actually a fun conversation, so be sure to tune in.